So according to scientists, the most complex living structure in the universe is that of the human brain. The human brain possesses about 100 billion neurons with roughly 1 quadrillion, that's 1 million billion, connections known as synapses, wiring these cells together, making it arguably more powerful than all the digital computers in the world combined. Well, that's according to the Inc.com anyway. So artificial intelligence, or AI, has been a buzzword for quite a while. But one of the great mysteries of AI is that despite becoming billions of times more powerful over the past 50 years, computers have only become marginally better at and completely fail at many tasks that the human brain does instantly. The computational power, the memory storage capabilities, and the access efficiency of the human brain are phenomenal. However, despite this incredible creation, indeed the very pinnacle of God's creation, the human brain is still unable to process the full spectrum of sensory data that is constantly flooding its receptors. Take eyesight, for example. As we look around the room, billions of photons are hitting our retinas, providing our brains with an enormous amount of information regarding colour, shade, depth, shape, movement, as well as structure, form, and utility. It is simply not possible for our brains to provide adequate and equal proportional processing capability to everything that our eyes are seeing, our ears are hearing, our nose smelling, our skin feeling, or our mouths tasting, all at the same time. So to deal with this reality, God has created the ability for the brain to apply a complex, adaptive, and rapid shifting concentration system, such that we're able to zoom in and to focus on certain aspects of our sensory input while ignoring others. If we didn't have this, we just wouldn't be able to function. Indeed, our brains are constantly shifting through reams of sensory data and selecting what aspects to draw attention to and what to discard. So then this begs a question, a serious question. How does our brain decide what to bring attention to and what to ignore? Said another way, what determines the basis of our perceptual filter? In their analysis of the brain and people's behaviour, psychologists have identified that our brains use a pre-existing or a priori schema or value structure to identify what is most important. Now, this schema is a cognitive framework or concept that helps to organise and interpret information. Think of this schema as a complex hierarchy of values that our brain uses to determine what information presents the most value against achieving a specific goal or task. This priori value structure stems from our experiences, learnings, patterns of behaviour, knowledge, and of course, our beliefs. But it's centred around and indeed arises from the need to achieve an aim. Once the brain locks on to a target or an aim, it can then use past experiences, learnings, patterns of behaviour, etc., to rank those things that have value in the context of whether they help or hinder us achieving that aim. Now, this probably sounds a bit complicated, so let me try and give a simple example. You may have heard of the gorilla experiment. It was made famous in the late 90s. So imagine you're asked to watch a short video in which 6 people, 3 with white shirts and 3 with black shirts, pass basketballs to each other while moving randomly around. While you watch, you must keep a silent count of the number of passes made by only the people in the white shirts. At some point, a person dressed in a gorilla suit slowly strolls into the middle of the screen, faces the camera, and thumps his chest and then leaves, spending 9 seconds on the screen. Would you see the gorilla? Of course, everybody says, of course we would. But in actual fact, 50% of all people who do the test fail to see the gorilla. So what's going on here? It's not like their eyes don't see the gorilla. Now, this phenomenon is called inattention or perceptual blindness, as it concerns primarily the visual field. However, psychologists have gone further and suggest that it's a systemic function of the brain. It's what we do all the time in every sense. In other words, it's not just limited to the sensory visual perception, but all perception, perhaps we could say all understanding, undergoes this process. So let's break this down a bit more. In the gorilla experiment, the participants are motivated to participate, and this will become important later. They are then set a task or an aim, which in this case is to count the number of passes made by the white shirts. Now that the brain has a motivation and is now acting out that motivation, their brains are able to apply a value structure that focuses their perception on the information that is of most value to achieving success, which is to count the number of passes. The person in the gorilla suit is simply irrelevant to successfully achieving the task, and so 50% of the people who do the tests, their brains do not see the gorilla. So in other words, they don't allow that perception to come to the foremost of their brains. Now, what if we consider this in a much broader sense? When you think about it, everything we do has some kind of aim and is a product of some kind of motivation, conscious or unconscious. Take another little example, like getting a drink of water. The results from this motivation are, we're thirsty. That's the motivation. Then we act on that motivation and then we go get a glass of water. What's interesting is that as we go through the act of going into the kitchen, getting some water, our brains apply a value structure such that we will focus our perception on the things that will help us achieve getting a drink or the things that will indeed stop us, although not until they're just about to block us. So when we see an empty glass on the countertop, we do not see it as an object and then infer its use. Now, that would take too long and require too much effort. No, the value structure that we have developed enables us to actually see instantly the glass as a water-holding vessel. In other words, we perceive the utility, not the object, in the context of what we're aiming for. What is also interesting is that, say, someone was in the kitchen as we go to get that glass of water, and they reach to open a door that would block our path, we will not actually perceive the problem of the door until it's almost about to hit us. Our value structure only applies value when failure is immediately imminent. Now, I find this stuff fascinating and instantly relatable, but it has some serious implications. This means that how we perceive the world is determined by how we act in the world, which is directed by our motivation. As we walk into the kitchen to get a drink, our brain is automatically filtering information to focus our perception on the things that will aid us getting a drink and ignoring the things that won't. Motivation, thirsty. Action, get a drink. Perception, water-holding vessel, equals success. Door equals failure. That's how our brain processes. So then we need to understand that on a very primal and deep way, we are motivated, act, and then we perceive the world. Motivation, action, and then perception. Now, this can seem a little counterintuitive. Initially, I would have said that we perceive the world first, are motivated, and then act on that motivation. But the reality is, it's that our motivation and action provides our brains with the detail to determine what information is important and what is not. Therefore, our motivation sets how we act or behave, how we then perceive the world around us. Our actions and perceptions are preset by our motivations. So now, after that rather lengthy introduction, I'm at the heart of what I'd like to discuss today. And it's simply this. What motivates your life? What motivates your life? What is the thing that compels you to act and by which you perceive the world around you? what motivates your life. And I don't mean motivations that come and go, like getting the next promotion or pay rise, finding a spouse, building friendships, or other such worthwhile but temporal pursuits. Being motivated to get a speedboat is not what I'm talking about, although nice a boat would be. What is your overarching motivation in life? What motivates you day in, day out? What drives your purpose in life? Simple to ask, maybe, not so simple to answer. So let me ask a different question that may help us frame our answer. What was Jesus Christ's motivation? What motivated him? What was his life's overarching motivation? If you were to use a couple of words to describe what motivated Christ in his relatively short life, what would they be? What determined how he acted in the world, how he perceived the world? So please turn with me now to John 12, and we'll try to answer this question. John 12. And this is the events just leading up to the final Passover, which starts in chapter 13. So John 12, verse 46. And this is Christ, and it appears that he's talking to disciples. There may be other people there, but he's at least talking to the disciples. And he says this: I have come into the world as light, so that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness. If anyone hears my words and does not keep them, I do not judge him. For I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. Now the word to judge here means this: properly to distinguish, that is, decide mentally or judicially, by implication to try, condemn, punish. On the other hand, to save means to keep safe and sound, to rescue from danger or destruction, to save a suffering one from perishing, one suffering from disease to make well, heal, restore to health, to preserve one who is in danger of destruction. So Christ contrasts here these two ideas, to judge on one hand and to save on the other, as diametric opposites, mutually exclusive concepts. Go to Luke 19. This is the story of Zacchaeus. I always pronounce his name wrong. Zacchaeus. So this is the little guy who couldn't see. He was a tax collector. He was quite rich. And he ends up climbing a tree so that he can see Christ. And Christ sees him. And then if we start in verse 9, this is what Christ says when he sees him. Then Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house because he too is a son of Abraham, even though he was a tax collector. For the Son of Man came to seek out and to save the lost." To save the lost. Again in Luke 9, this is about the Samaritan village. Luke 9 and 51. "Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem." So Jesus knew that he was getting close to his end, and it was time for him to go to Jerusalem. "And he sent messengers before his face, and they went and they entered the village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they," the Samaritans, "did not receive him because his face was set on the journey to Jerusalem." So there was a bit of tension between the Samaritans and the Jews of the time. The Samaritans had a different location where they worshipped, and they felt their location was the correct one, and so they resented the Jews thinking they had to go to Jerusalem. So that's why they didn't want Christ there, because he was on his way to worship somewhere where they thought was wrong. So they weren't going to let him stay and hang around because he was going to Jerusalem. "And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, 'Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did?'" Now, James and John were thinking, all right, these are the Samaritans, right? They're not even Jews. So it doesn't really matter. And they might as well you know, wait until the return to get judged properly. But Christ turned and rebuked him and said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you're of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." And they went to another village. If we consider these words of Christ, if we consider the numerous, perhaps thousands of people that he healed, the people that he cast out demons from, the numerous sinners that he dined with, if we consider the way he interacted, the way he talked to the people, to the disciples, to Mary and Martha, the Samaritan woman who had multiple husbands, to the woman caught in the act of adultery, it's perhaps obvious, isn't it? If we consider Christ's perception and his actions throughout his life, it is clear that he was motivated to save. Not judge, to save. His final words, as he just before he died, he says this, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." He was motivated to save. When Christ perceived the actions of those around him, when he sought to do something, to act in the world, he was driven by a very clear aim, to save. Christ knew that judgment would come, but that was not now. That would be the end time. Now he had one aim and one aim only, to save. Ultimately, this aim would accumulate in him giving up his life to achieve it. But don't think that his death was just one event, a single, isolated, incredible, unselfish act. No, Christ's whole life was motivated in big ways and in small ways to saving people, to protecting people, to healing what was broken. He was motivated to seek out and to save the lost. He did not think that it was enough that his death would just take care of it. No, his whole life motivation was to save. And as a result, he perceived the world differently from the Pharisees, from the Sadducees, from the scribes and the leaders of the time, even from his own disciples. He perceived the world through the eyes of someone whose aim, whose life's goal was to save it. We are called to be like Christ. So shouldn't this be our life's goal? Shouldn't our motivation in life be to save? Or is that something only the Son of God was here to do? Something indeed only he could do? And now that he's died and is risen, do we simply look to his return, making sure that we keep the holy days, the Sabbath, the law? Should that be our life's motivation? Do we get to contract out the whole saving thing by paying our tithes and letting church headquarters and God concern themselves with the saving bit? Let's consider Paul. Let's consider Paul in 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19. Paul says this, "I am free. I belong to no other person, but I make myself a slave to everyone. I do this to help save as many people as I can. To the Jews, I became like a Jew so that I could help save Jews. I myself am not ruled by the law, but to those who are ruled by the law, I became like someone who is ruled by the law. I did this to help save those who are ruled by the law. To those who are without the law, I became like someone who is without the law. I did this to help save those who are without the law. But really, I am not without God's law. I am ruled by the law of Christ. To those who are weak, I became weak so that I could save them. I have become all things to all people. I did this so that I could save people in any way possible." Paul said, imitate me, just as I also imitate Christ. There is no doubt that Paul was motivated to save, and this was lockstep with Christ's motivation. Surely this means that every one of us must be deeply and clearly motivated to save. I believe so, but it may not mean what you think it means, and I'll come back to that a little later. So let's keep considering other examples in the Bible of a motivation to save. Of Peter, it says in Acts 2:40, he pressed his case with many other arguments and kept pleading with them, save yourselves from this perverse generation. Consider Stephen. As the people threw stones at him, crushing him to death, he cried out, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. He was motivated to save, not judge. And therefore he perceived the world as Christ did, and he beseeched God to forgive them, just like Christ did. Paul also talks about Priscilla and Aquila risking their necks for his life. And it's not just New Testament characters. We have Abraham, who beseeched God not to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, starting at 50 righteous men and working all the way down to just 10 righteous men, doing whatever he could to save the cities. What about Job, sacrificing whenever his sons and daughters got together, just in case they did something wrong? And then finally, at the end, when God's anger burns against his friends, he tells Job, so you sacrifice for them, and then I will forgive you. And Job did. What about Moses? Moses, this is a great story in Exodus 32. So please turn with me. Exodus 32. Now this is just... Moses has gone up, he's received the Ten Commandments, and while he's been gone, the Israelites have run amok and they've gone and built a golden calf. And Moses doesn't know this, but God tells him. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. Was Moses' response, go ahead, God, no worries. No, Moses implored the Lord his God, it says. He went on and pleaded with him for a while. And at the end of his plea, this is what God says. And the Lord relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing onto his people. In verse 14. But if we drop down to 30, verse 30. And the next day Moses said to the people, you have sinned a great sin. And now I'll go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sin. But if not, please blot out me out of your book that you have written. Pretty amazing words. Basically saying, God, if you don't forgive them, then I should be destroyed with them. And of course, God listened to him. All these men and women, and there were others of the Bible, all had a motivation to save, a motivation that compelled them to act in the world a certain way, and therefore they perceived the world, if only for a moment, as Christ did. We have been called to follow Christ, to develop the value structure that he had, to act in the world in the same way that he did. And in so doing, we will perceive the world as he did. We will be motivated to save and not judge. Let's quickly go through a few verses that specifically talk to us. 1 Corinthians 7:16. No need to turn there. 1 Corinthians 7:16. For how do you know, O wife, whether you shall save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you shall save your wife? Interesting stuff. 1 Timothy 4:16, pay attention to yourself and to the teaching. Continue in them, for in this, doing this, you shall save both yourself and those who hear you. In James 5:15, the prayer of faithful will save the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. If he has committed sins, he will be forgiven because of the prayer. So confess your offenses to one another and pray for one another as that you may be healed. The effective prayer of a righteous person is very powerful. Verse 20 of James 5. Let him know that he who turns a sinner from straying of his way shall save a life from death and cover a great multitude of sins. Psalms 82:4, rescue the poor and needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wrong. Proverbs 11:30, the fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and he who is winning lives is wise. In Christ's final hours, right before he suffered and gave his life, he sat his disciples down and said this in John 15:12. John 15:12. This is my command, that you keep on loving each other just as I have loved you. No one has greater love than a person who lays down his life for his friends. What does it mean to lay down your life for your friends? It means that you'll do whatever it takes to save them, even if it means your life. That's what Christ is talking about here. This is what we're called into, a body of people motivated to save one another and by extension the world. This is at the heart of the foot washing that we perform every Passover, a willingness to do whatever it takes to clean and therefore to save, even if it means our own death. Judgment is coming, but it's not now. Nor is it our domain, nor should we use discernment as a cloak for judgment. In Luke 6:37, Christ says, do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Pardon and you will be pardoned. Give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, overflowing, will be given into your lap. For whatever measure you measure out, you will be measured back to you. Could we not say, save? And you will be saved. Christ's followers are motivated to save, not judge. Let me begin to wrap this up. At the start, I talked about how our brain functions in light of the copious amount of information bombarding our sensory systems. How God has designed a system within our brains that applies a priori value structure to everything we do, enabling us to perceive the world based on how we act and what motivates us. I showed that Christ's motivation was the basis of how he acted and therefore how he perceived the world, which from his own words was to save, not to judge. I then suggested that not only was this Christ's motivation, but also Peter's, Paul's, Stephen's, and a host of other biblical characters. If not their life's motivation, then at least their motivation at a profound moment in their lives. And I then suggested that it naturally follows that this too should be our motivation, that we should be motivated to save just as Christ was so motivated. Indeed, this is a commitment we renew every Passover when we wash each other's feet. But what does this all mean, practically speaking? Sounds a bit theoretical, a bit pie in the kind of stuff. So what should we do with all this? What does it mean for us to be motivated to save? Am I suggesting that we need to each go out and stand on the street corner and preach the gospel, warning people of the coming lake of fire, like some do? Am I suggesting that we make a personal commitment to find someone to save regardless of what they think or understand? No, none of that would save. I think we all know that. What I have sketched out today is something that I believe is a deep conceptual idea that is worth meditating on and analysing in the context of our lives. Pondering our personal motivations and seeking to align them with Christ's motivation to save and not to judge. All this is well and good, but what is a practical application of this concept? What can we do differently to strive to be motivated to save? In the last few minutes, I would like to sketch three possible actions that we could take. Indeed, there are many, many more, and I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on any other examples. So here's my first. Don't focus on the differences, celebrate what is in common. Whether at work, at school, or around our neighbourhoods, whether interacting with others or just thinking about people in other religions, cultures, ethnic backgrounds, people that are living sexually immoral lives or who are politically extreme from us. When we consider the people of the world, strive to dwell on the things that we share. The things that we have in common. Strive to find the things that they have that are good, that are pure. It's so easy to solely focus on the fact that they teach this and they believe that and they do this and they're all like that. never once considering that they suffer like us. They care for others like us. They believe like us. They seek purpose like us. In so many ways, they are just like us. For they need saving just like us. If all we do is draw attention to the differences, to the errors, to the wrongness around us, then we will have been motivated to judge, not to save. We would have already perceived the world as something to judge and not something to save. Paul knew this. When he entered Athens, he found a thread of a thing that he had in common with the people of Athens, despite the city being full of idolatry. A thread that he could build upon and potentially use to save some of them. It would have been all too easy for Paul to focus on the differences with the Athenians, their sins, their corruption, and simply journey on to the next city. No, instead, Paul, motivated to save, celebrated their religiousness and their acknowledgement of an unknown God as a means to establish common ground and then work to save. Here's my second one. Seek the truth and learn to speak it. I've spoken on this before, so I'll not dwell on it, but I believe if we seek truth about life, about God, and about ourselves, we will not judge. If we can see the truth about ourselves, are able to articulate it and truly examine it, then this will be like a natural antidote to judging others. Instead, it will enhance our motivation to save, as we see the need for our own saving ever more clearly. Not only that, but truly seeking the truth brings with it a required degree of humility, and I'm yet to see someone motivated to judge from a humble attitude. Learning to speak truth with love will help us know when to hold our tongue and when there's an opportunity to talk openly and precisely. Truth is the foundation of salvation, and therefore if we are motivated to save, we will be seeking the truth and learning to speak it. And my last point, my last suggestion. Never give up on people or write them off. The moment we think there is no hope for people like that or who do that kind of thing, whatever it is, we have again crossed into perceiving the world to judge and not to save. No matter what people have done, no matter what they are doing right now, or the things that they are saying or believing, they are always worth saving. Who knows, maybe we will be the ones to save them. So pray for them. Pray for those who have rejected God's way, for those that have done you wrong, but don't pray that they would come back or that they would see their error. Rather, pray that God forgive them, that he protect them, that they be blessed, that he abide with them. Pray, God, do not hold this sin against them. Right up to the very end, there remains a hope. Indeed, a whole mighty host in heaven, willing them on, striving to help people enter the kingdom. Let us lend our voice, indeed our whole life's motivation, to save even if only one. In Daniel 12, verse 3, talking about the end, it says this, those who manifest wisdom will shine like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who turn many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. When someone new comes through those doors to fellowship with us, let them leave knowing that this group is motivated to protect, motivated to heal the broken, and motivated to save and not judge.